KFAI, 90.3 FM in Minneapolis, and on the web at kfai.org. Radio without boundaries.
The viewpoints expressed in this program are the opinions of the people expressing them and are not necessarily those of Fresh Air Incorporated, its staff, or its board of directors.
Run into Luke. Your first name is King. Last name is Dumb. 'Cause you still believe in everyone. From heat, the electric one, just to shock you, see, he left us the sun. Atoms in the air, organisms in the sea, sun and yes man, are made of the same things. Freedom! 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 Freedom, 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 freedom.
You are listening to KFAI, Fresh Air Community Radio, 90.3 FM HD Minneapolis and 106.7 FM St. Paul. Online at kfai.org. Radio without boundaries.
You are listening to Fresh Air Radio, KFAI, 90.3 FM Minneapolis, and 106.7 in St. Paul. This is Health Notes from the Hearts of a Natural Woman.
This program will inspire you, inform you, feed you healthy recipes, engage you politically, enlighten you spiritually. Help me name it. I'm no longer doubtful of what I'm living for. And if I make you happy, I don't need to do more. 'Cause you make me feel.
You make me feel.
Good evening. You're listening to Fresh Air Community Radio, KFAI, 90.3 FM in Minneapolis, and we're streaming online at kfai.org. And this is Health Notes from the Hearts of a Natural Woman, and I'm Kinshasha. We are in conversation again with Mike Robbins. We haven't talked with Mike since
his first book, Be Yourself, Everyone Else is Already Taken. And since our last conversation, Mike has written two more amazing books. One, Focus on the Good Stuff, The Power of Appreciation, and Nothing Changes Until You Do, A Guide to Self-Compassion and Getting Out of Your Own Way. Share with our listeners about yourself and how you got into this kind of work.
I grew up here in the San Francisco Bay Area, where I still live. Played baseball most of my life. I was pretty good at it. I actually got drafted out of high school by the New York Yankees. Didn't end up signing a contract with the Yankees at that point because I got an opportunity to play baseball at Stanford. So I go to Stanford and play baseball there. Then I got drafted by the Kansas City Royals, signed a pro contract. And, you know, the way it works in baseball, you got to go into the minor leagues before you ultimately make it up to the major leagues. And that's what I did. I went into the minor leagues with Kansas City. Unfortunately for me, my third season in the minors with the Kansas City Royals, I went out to pitch one night and I threw one pitch and tore ligaments in my elbow and blew my arm out. So there I was at 23 years old after starting baseball when I was seven, and my career ended, my dream ended. It was, you know, it was pretty devastating for me. And, you know, the thing is, I looked back on the whole experience, you know, I was disappointed and pretty crushed about it as I was trying to move on with my life to figure out what I was going to do next. But, you know, I started to ask myself some really important questions. And one of the questions that I asked over and over again was, you know, did I have any regrets? If I could do it all over again, would I do anything different? And I didn't actually regret a lot of the stuff that I thought I would have, you know, like the games that I blew and the times I really messed things up. The thing that I really regretted was that I hadn't fully appreciated it while it was happening. You know, I was this kid raised in Oakland, California by a single mom. We didn't have a lot of money. I was going to hopefully make it to the major leagues one day and make some money and be somebody important. And, you know, but up to that point in my life, even though I was pretty good, I spent most of my time thinking that I wasn't good enough, comparing myself to everyone around me and literally like holding my breath, hoping that I didn't mess it up. And when it was all said and done and I hadn't made it, I thought to myself, oops, I think I missed the point. You know, so for me, it was a pretty painful way to learn a really important lesson relatively young in my life. And, you know, I moved back home. I got into the dot-com world. It was the 90s and worked for a few internet companies. And I started to notice some things just about life and about myself. And, so, you know, I'd always been interested in team dynamics and group dynamics when I was playing sports. And I was also fascinated by the fact that it didn't always seem like an individual's talent necessarily equated to their success. And it didn't also always seem to me that someone's success equated to their fulfillment in life. So these were the kind of questions I was asking myself and trying to get some help and some guidance from friends and mentors and coaches and counselors and people I was working with. And then when I lost my job in 2000 after the dot-com bubble burst, I thought to myself, you know, I want to explore this more deeply. In fact, that's what I really want to do for a living. So that's what I started to do. I started to read a lot of books, and people told me go back to school and, you know, get more education, which I love to learn, but I never really liked traditional education. So I just decided I would sort of design my own curriculum and see if I could make a living coaching people and speaking to people and starting to write some books of my own. And here we are 14 years later, and I get to talk to people on the radio like you.
I know that your first book, Be Yourself, Everyone Else is Taken, was a major, major success. And what came next was a book on appreciation.
Mm-hmm.
Why is appreciation? So the book is called Focus on the Good Stuff, The Power of Appreciation.
Yeah.
Why appreciation?
Well, you know, like that story I shared about my, you know, background. And I think what happens, you know, for me, like as an athlete, but I think this is true for all of us, it's not about, I mean, most of the people listening to us probably didn't have the experience like I did of playing pro baseball, but all of us have had the experience of having something taken away from us in our lives, or something go away, or some, you know, a relationship ends, a job ends, we deal with some kind of, you know, physical or medical challenge, or, you know, somebody passes away. I mean, sometimes they can be really significant, sometimes less significant, but we often don't appreciate what we have while we have it. You know, sometimes you ever go to an event or go on vacation, you may really enjoy it while you're there, and then you get home and you start thinking back and it's like, oh, that was really amazing. And, you know, you miss it doing it, but there's almost a part of you who's like, wow, wish I would have enjoyed that even more. And, you know, that's the thing, as we look back on our lives, right? It's like we look back and we tend to glorify, oh, the good old days, right? Mm-hmm. But mostly the good old days, they were filled with ups and downs and twists and turns. And, you know, so really, I mean, I look at it as a personal and a spiritual practice of, can we actually appreciate the moments that we're in, the experiences that we have. You know, my wife and I have two girls who are 8 and 6 now, and it's interesting because one of the things from the time they were babies, I mean, people say, especially people older than us whose children are older than ours, they'll say things to us like, oh, it goes so fast, or oh, appreciate it, or, you know, and I appreciate the sentiment, although sometimes in the moment, especially like when I was dealing with a two-year-old throwing a tantrum in the shopping mall, I wasn't always appreciative of the person telling me to enjoy it, because I'm like, yeah, I don't really like this part. Mm-hmm. But I think what I've realized about that, when people have said that to me, and I even find myself now saying it to people when I see someone in the park with a baby or a toddler, I think what it is, there's wisdom in it, but I think there's a little bit of nostalgia and actually sometimes a little bit of sadness, like, I wish I would have enjoyed it more. I was so busy trying to do things and get stuff done and get to the next thing that maybe I didn't fully engage and appreciate the experience of it. So I think for all of us, wherever we are in life, whatever we're doing, being able to stop and appreciate ourselves, the people around us, and what we're doing, it's fundamental.
Just like you said, as far as our children, and it goes way too fast, as do so many other good experiences. And we have every intention of being present and appreciating it in the moment, yet we don't.
Yeah.
What kinds of things can we do so that we actually are present and we actually are appreciating what's going on? And I guess the other side of that, because as humans we're so predictable, what benefits do we get from raising our appreciation rate and being more present?
A couple of things. I think the first thing we got to do is pay attention and, you know, notice when we're not paying attention, so to speak. I mean, it's a bit of a paradox, but start to notice without judgment, without criticism towards ourselves, but be aware. What am I doing? You know, again, if we notice that we're not present, or we notice that we're not engaged, or we notice that we're not appreciative, then that gives us the opportunity to make a different choice. Start to see the impact of it. You know, my counselor, Eleanor, who I write a lot about in my most recent book, Nothing Changes Until You Do, she talks to me a lot about change. You know, she talks about the sort of four steps of the change process. She says you got to recognize, acknowledge, forgive, and change. So we recognize, what am I doing? Acknowledge the impact of it. If it's something that's maybe not the most healthy or most loving or most kind to ourselves or most conducive to our own success and fulfillment. So recognize it. Oh, I'm doing that. Acknowledge it. What's the impact? How does that make me feel? What's the, you know, impact of whatever it is I'm doing? Then forgive. Forgive ourselves. Genuinely bring a sense of self-forgiveness, self-compassion. And then the change, as Eleanor's taught me over the years, happens pretty naturally if we actually forgive ourselves. But what she said to me early on with this process, she said, Mike, you, like most people, do it this way. You go recognize, acknowledge, punish, and repeat. And that's why you keep repeating the cycle. So the thing about gratitude and appreciation, to your other part of your question, why is it important? First of all, it's actually really good for our health. And I know, you know, you talk a lot on the show about healthy living and what people can do. It's one of the best things we can do, not just mentally and emotionally, but even physiologically. That if you literally just sitting, listening to us right now, wherever you are, at home, in your car, on the computer, wherever you might be listening to this, just take a moment right now. Think of someone or something that you love. Just bring that into your awareness. What do you love about this person or this thing you're thinking of? What do you appreciate about them or about whatever it is? Just start to think about that and answer that question in your mind. Just doing that, just for the last 10 seconds or so as I ask that question, if you stop and ponder that, bring someone or something into your awareness that you love and appreciate, just that alone, it actually changes the chemistry in your brain. It literally starts to produce more serotonin in your brain. It reduces some of the stress hormones that we carry that are running through our system constantly that we're not even conscious of. And just that, like I say to people all the time, you know, Kinshasa, I speak all over the country, all over the world now, and a lot of the people that bring me in to speak are corporations, organizations. So I come in and talk to these organizations, and I'm talking to salespeople, or I'm talking to leaders, or I'm talking to people who work in, you know, different parts of the organization, and I'll often say, look, being appreciative and grateful, we can talk about it in terms of teamwork and communication and trust and all that stuff, and I'll get to that, but just on a very personal level, if you start building in a practical gratitude or appreciation practice into your daily routine, it will lower your stress level. It'll make you more effective at your job. It'll actually make you enjoy your work more, even if this isn't your favorite thing in the whole world to do. Like just staring out the window a couple times a day, or looking at a photo of your children or your family, or even just taking a walk around the office and taking a few breaths and asking myself the question, what am I grateful for? It makes a difference physiologically. And then emotionally and relationally, the more we start to focus on it, look, think about our most important relationships. Could be, again, people we work with, could be people we live with, it could be the people in our family, whoever it is. There are very few people, I have never met someone in my life, in all the years I've been doing this and traveling around talking to people, who've said this to me, you know what, Mike, I'm just too appreciated. Like, you know, my spouse just appreciates me too much, or my kids is just annoying, like stuff. No, you can't over-appreciate another human being if you do it authentically. And it's usually the primary reason for conflict in our relationships is a lack of appreciation. Any fight we get into with our partner, with our coworker, any frustration that we have often is an experience, a feeling, often a mutual feeling of lack of appreciation. Right? My wife and I actually had the opportunity to go, and Oprah Winfrey was doing this big, you know, Life You Want to Live tour and traveling around, and it was great. We got to go see her and some other wonderful people who spoke at this particular event. And she said this great thing when she was speaking. She was talking about all her years in interviewing people, and she said, look, I've interviewed everybody. I mean, presidents, prime ministers, I've interviewed, you know, famous people, I've interviewed people who've gone through tragedy, I've interviewed, literally any type of person you could possibly imagine, I've interviewed them over the course of my career in television. And she said, after every interview that I've ever conducted, almost everyone asked me some version of the same question. Interview's over, camera shuts off, they lean over and they say, how was that? Like, how'd I do? And she said, you know, it used to confuse me early on in my career. Like, why do these people need my feedback? I don't understand. Like, some of these people were very, very successful and accomplished. Like, what? She goes, and then I realized they're actually not asking me how they did. Like, for validation purpose, they're actually, here's what they're really asking me. Did you see me? Did you hear me? Did what I say matter? And what she said was, and I agree with her 100%, that's actually, those questions, people are asking all the time, and if we can be the kind of people that answer those questions for others, yes, I see you. Yes, I hear you. Yes, who you are and what you say matters. That's how we appreciate other human beings. And what I've learned, Kinshasa, over the years of doing this work around appreciation is that appreciation, relationally, while it may seem like it's about the other person and it's a gift for the other person, and it is, it's one of those amazing gifts in life that when we give it away, we actually get to keep it ourselves. So it literally wins for them and for us. It's a virtuous cycle.
Guess it's true, I'm not good at a one-night stand. But I still need love, cause I'm just a man. These nights never seem to go to plan. I don't want you to leave, will you hold my hand? Oh, won't you stay with me? Cause you're all. This is not a good look, gain some self-control. And deep down I know this never works. But you can lay with me so it doesn't hurt. Oh, won't you stay with me? Cause you're
Support for KFAI comes from First Avenue, presenting Jackie Venson at the Turf Club, Sunday, May 17th. Rock, blues, jazz, funk, Jackie Venson does it all. With her latest release, The Love Anthology, she breaks boundaries, defies description, and smoothly navigates along the entire spectrum of music. At the center of it all, Jackie Venson holds true to her vision and her story. Opening the show is Woolly Mac. More information about Jackie Venson, live at the Turf Club, is available at first-avenue.com.
Hey folks, do you ever wish you could turn back the clock and get rid of those stubborn fine lines and wrinkles? Well, I think I found the perfect solution for you. Introducing Metal Meltdown Part 8 on KFAI. That's right. It's the 8th annual 24-hour metal tribute to Earl Root. Here's how it works. At the stroke of midnight on Sunday, May 24th, just put your face up to the speaker, turn the knob up to 11, and let your face melt with the abrasive sounds of metal provided by our KFAI volunteers for this year's fundraising event. Also, for maximum results, you're going to want to listen to all 24 hours and make sure to hit that donate button at kfai.org. Side effects may include uncontrollable head banging and horn throwing, as well as the urge to stage dive from your living room furniture. Tune in on May 24th to KFAI 90.3 FM Minneapolis St. Paul. You'll feel great and be better looking in no time.
We're talking with Mike Robbins this evening on Health Notes. We're talking about his newest contribution to all of us. Focus on the good stuff, the power of appreciation, and nothing changes until you do a guide to self-compassion and getting out of your own way. You know, I was thinking about what you said was just amazing, and your absolutely right. I think from the standpoint of being in conversation with someone on the side of being an interviewer, we want to know that we did a good job too, and that
right.
and that people are pleased with the way that we represented them. And you know, I was just thinking about you go to a lot of corporations, and when I think of corporations, I think of a lot of miscommunications and how much people do not appreciate one another and sometimes don't respect one another, and their lack of respect or feeling like somebody else is incompetent or maybe even hurting the organization. And my negativity towards you is seemingly my negativity towards myself.
Yeah.
How is it possible to have appreciation in situations where it's really kind of hard to find anything to like about what's going on?
Yeah, like, I mean, it's easy to talk about. It's a whole other thing to practice it. I mean, look, the thing to remember, and I say this all the time when I'm speaking inside of these organizations, and look, I mean, I'm so blessed. I get hired by companies like Google and Wells Fargo and Microsoft and Charles Schwab. I mean, these really big, successful companies. And the funny thing is, the things I'm talking about and teaching there, I sort of feel like they fall into the category of, you know, Robert Fulghum wrote that great book about 20, 25 years ago called Everything I Ever Needed to Know I Learned in Kindergarten. That's kind of the stuff that I'm talking about. Like, how can we be kind to each other? How can we be respectful and appreciative of one another? But the thing is, appreciation doesn't mean like, necessarily. Doesn't mean agree with. Doesn't mean, hey, I think this person's really wonderful. Why don't you come out to lunch with me? Why don't you come, we'll watch the football game together, or we'll go shopping, or, you know. It's great if you happen to like the people you work with. That's fantastic. That just makes life so much better. It makes work so much better. But the reality is, just like, by the way, within our family, right, we don't necessarily like everybody, but then there's people we got to deal with. So the thing about appreciation, it's about recognizing people's value inherently, like that they have value. Now, they may or may not be superstars at their job, right? So I make a distinction between recognition, which is about people's performance, and appreciation, which is about who people are. And so the thing is that if you separate those two things out, now when I have to, if let's say I'm a manager or something at work, or even just a coworker of yours, if I really like the job that you're doing, and I think you're doing a good job, I might recognize you for that, thank you for that, acknowledge you in some way, maybe formally, maybe more informally, but like, hey, great job. Irrespective of your job and your performance, there's you as a human being. And even if you and I don't necessarily get along, what can I do to appreciate, right? Like Oprah said, do I see you? Do I hear you? Do I let you know that who you are and what you have to say matter? And here's the thing. My belief is this at a deeper, more personal level. We don't see other people as they are. We see them as we are, as you alluded to even in your question. So much the opportunity for us to figure out how we interact with other human beings. Look, this is what my new book, Nothing Changes Until You Do, is all about. We're the common denominator in every relationship that we have.
Mm-hmm.
So when we shift, everything else can shift. And, you know, if we want to have influence on people and we want to make a difference for people, or even just have more positive relationships with people, whether we like them or not, we got to remember that we're bringing something to the party. You know, Martin Luther King said it this way. He said, we have no morally persuasive power with those who can feel our underlying contempt for them. So people are asking me all the time inside of these organizations, like, how do I influence this person or this group over there? And I'll often say, well, how do you feel about them? Well, I don't like them, or doesn't seem like they respect me or trust me. I'll say, okay, well, look, you're bringing that energy into the conversation every time. So we got to sort of clean up our own side of the street. Now, this doesn't mean we don't have difficult conversations from time to time. We don't give feedback. It doesn't mean all of a sudden Pollyanna has put on rose-colored glasses and everything's wonderful and it's fine, no problem. No, that's not the real world that we live in. But it's like a practice. Just like in our own lives, it's a practice if we're going to focus on the good stuff and be grateful and appreciative. It's a practice to do it with other people. And if we're dealing with people in our lives right now that we're finding difficult or challenging, one of the many things we can appreciate about them is what they're teaching us. Because the difficult and challenging people that show up in our lives often teach us enormous lessons about boundaries, about communication, about expectations, about kindness, about holding grudges, about all kinds of super valuable things, but we don't stop to appreciate that. We get caught up in the drama and the story called, he's a jerk, or she gets on my nerves, or whatever it is, and then we get all justified and righteous about why we're right and they're wrong, and then we go gossip about them. And nobody wins, right? And then I come into the organization, they go, yeah, it's really negative around here, and I'm like, oh, it is, really? Where's that coming from? right? What can we do? We can do what Gandhi taught us, right? Be the change. A lot of this stuff that I talk about and write about, it seems like simple concepts on the surface, and it is, but when we go down a little more deeply into it, some of this stuff is actually quite complex.
In Focus on the Good Stuff, you ask us to consider acknowledging other people from our hearts.
Mm-hmm.
Talk about that heart thing and acknowledging people. I think that we tend to believe that if we use our hearts, that it will make us vulnerable.
Well, it will. You know, it's interesting, the thing about vulnerability, I mean, so much of my work, you know, in all three of my books, I talk about vulnerability in different ways. I was speaking at an event in Japan not that long ago. First time I'd ever spoken at an event in Japan. Had 300 people in the audience. None of them spoke English, so it was a simultaneous translation. And before the event started, before I got up to speak, I went to meet with the translators because they were going to be translating what I was saying, and we were talking, and of course they spoke English and Japanese. And this one woman asked me a question, or she was asking me about some of the stuff I was going to be talking about, and I told her that at one point I was going to spend a good amount of time talking about vulnerability. And she says, vulnerability? And I said, yeah, vulnerability. She said, there's no word for that in Japanese. And I said,
wow.
There isn't? No, I don't know much about Japanese culture, let alone the language. I said, really? What? And she says, well, there is a word, but it's a bad word. And I said, what do you mean? And she said, well, it means weakness. And I said, oh, it means the same thing in English.
Hmm.
I said, we just have a negative connotation with it. But vulnerability, while on the certain level does mean or can be perceived as weakness, it's actually that's where a lot of our power comes from and our strength and our ability to connect with other human beings. And she, like, didn't quite, not only did she not agree with me, she wasn't even quite sure it was a good idea. And I said, listen, do me a favor, just translate what I say. If they don't understand or don't like it, then let me deal with that. And after my presentation, she comes running over to me and she goes, now I know what you're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
And she said, I realize vulnerability's not necessarily bad, it's just hard. I said, you're right. So yeah, acknowledging people from our heart does make us vulnerable. We open our heart. We might potentially get our feelings hurt. We might potentially, right? This is one of the reasons it holds us back from actually expressing our appreciation. What if they use it against me? What if they make fun of me? What if somehow they think I'm, you know, they perceive it somehow negatively? Even this positive thing of expressing our appreciation. So the difference between doing it from our head in a more academic kind of way and doing it from our heart has to do with allowing ourselves to feel emotion, right? And one of the ways we can actually allow our appreciation to impact other people is to really have it come from our heart. And how do we do that? Who is the person? What have they done? What quality do they have? What impact have they had on us? You know, I was speaking earlier about that Oprah event. The most poignant moment of the entire event for me, and I got so much out of it, and there were speakers there like Iyanla VanZant, who I really love, and Deepak Chopra was there, and Elizabeth Gilbert, who wrote Eat, Pray, Love. At the end of the event, Oprah had some of the speakers out on stage, and it was the last event of the eight that they'd done around the country, and Elizabeth Gilbert, who's the author of Eat, Pray, Love, who I'm a big fan of, had loved her speech at the event, loved her work. She said, Oprah, look, we all tried to figure out what gift we could get for you. She says to the audience, Oprah Winfrey's not the easiest person to buy a gift for because she kind of has everything and can do anything. So we decided, instead of getting you something, each of us wanted to let you know what we've learned from you and what we appreciate about this experience, just this eight-city tour where we got to travel around with you. And it was beautiful because what Liz Gilbert said, she said, my favorite part, you know, we've gotten to know each other over the last few years and I've been on your show and been interviewed and all that, but spending this time with you over this, you know, these events, I got to be with you in some private moments and see you interact with people. And she said, I've been so touched and so just in awe of you. She said, because you never let your greatness get in the way of your goodness.
Hmm.
And when she said it, Oprah started crying. Liz started crying. I'm in the audience with the 10,000 other people. I started crying. My wife started crying. It was because it was like she let her know, here's the impact you've had on me. And not because you're this great, amazing person on the world, which she is, but because here's what I saw. And it was like literally of the whole event, the two-day event, like that moment right there, I turned to my wife and we were both in tears and I was like, wow, that was really powerful and meaningful. And that also was such a great example of the power of appreciation, because you can't make that up. As Eleanor says to me all the time, Mike, the truth can't be rehearsed, so it has to come in the moment and be real.
We're talking with Mike Robbins this evening on Health Notes. Focus on the good stuff. The power of appreciation. You know, as difficult as it is to appreciate others in our world, appreciating ourselves seems to be the most difficult challenge that we have.
Yeah.
What do you suggest?
For sure. Again, I mean, I think it's really about awareness. In my own experience, this is why I've written the books that I've written. You know, I think the most important and challenging relationship, at least human relationship, that we have is the one with ourselves. And for the most part, even those of us who are positive people, whatever, you know, however we determine that, most people I know struggle with their relationship with themselves, how they feel about themselves, how they talk to themselves, how we, right? I mean, that's been, for me, over all my life, probably the most challenging relationship I've had. Because everywhere we go, there we are, right? We can't get away from ourselves. I mean, even back when I was an athlete, one of my biggest fears, you know, was failing. But it wasn't so much about the failure itself. It was dealing with myself after the failure. I'd have to go home. I was a pitcher in baseball, right? And even if you don't know much about baseball, pitchers don't pitch every game. So there's a lot of baseball games, as you may notice, when the baseball season's going on. There's game after game after game. But a pitcher, a starting pitcher, only pitches once every five games. And a relief pitcher may come in a couple times a week or may not for a while. There's a lot of time in between. So baseball is such a challenging mental game because you have so much time to reflect upon what you've done or not done. So when I would fail, the days between the bad game and to the next one, and then if I had two or three in a row, it was like horrible because I had to sit in my own negative stew where what was going on the whole time was all of that critical negative thinking about how bad I had performed. And because it was so important to me, I was young and, you know, I wrapped up all of my own self-worth in that. And again, a lot of us do this with our jobs. We do this with our bodies or our appearance. We do it with our bank account. We do it with our relationship status. Whatever it may be, we decide these certain things about ourselves, determine our worth or value in the world, and then we go to town on ourselves about it. So again, I mean, I think it's part of just being aware of that and then bringing a sense of self-compassion to ourselves to realize, oh, I don't have to do that. I can be kinder to myself. Because self-appreciation and ultimately self-compassion, it's not about thinking I'm the greatest person in the world. Hey, look at me, I'm wonderful. I mean, it's fine if we have confidence and believe in ourselves, but it's really about being kind and gentle and loving to ourselves in the moment. I saw this great quote online from Brené Brown a couple of months ago, and she said, talk to yourself as though you're talking to someone you really love. You know, and most of us, the way we talk to ourselves, the way we think about ourselves in our own quiet moments, we would never say those things to anyone else, especially someone we loved and cared about, and expect them to love us in return and want to hang out with us, right? Imagine if we spoke to our spouse or our children or our friends or our coworkers the way we often speak to ourselves. So, and the thing is, though, you know, Kinshasa, we don't get a lot of training or even focus around this. Because sometimes even the thought of or the conversation about appreciating ourselves or having compassion for ourselves or loving ourselves, it's often seen as kind of narcissistic and self-absorbed. Mm-hmm. But in reality, look, every one of us learned it at some level. My mother taught me, you know, you can't love anyone else until you what?
Mm-hmm.
Love yourself.
Yes.
But no one really encourages us to love ourselves or to know how to do that, or you're just supposed to get it. Like, just do it, right? I mean, even in the Bible, like, what does it say? Love thy neighbor as thyself. So that's all focused on how we're supposed to be kind to other people, but it's implied that we're supposed to love and be kind to ourselves first. But it's like, wait a minute, I never learned that in school. I didn't read a lot of books about that. I didn't see a lot of people around me doing that growing up. You know, it was like a lot about sacrifice. So again, I think it's something that we got to pay attention to and then realize for most of us, the muscle, if you will, around self-appreciation is pretty weak. And we got to find safe and healthy ways to practice appreciating and loving ourselves.
calm surrender to the rush of day. When the heat of a rolling wave can't be turned away, an enchanted moment, and it sees me through. It's enough for this restless warrior just to be with you. And can you feel the love tonight? It is where we are. It's enough for this wide-eyed wanderer that we got this far.
Tune into I Love You Minneapolis, Forget What I Said Yesterday with Masana's Musings, a series of interviews, conversations, and downloads that highlight the best, worst, and everything in between about Minneapolis and its twin sibling, St. Paul. Each broadcast, crafted with a Black, queer, non-binary, and second-gen Ugandan lens, guides the listener through the immersive, heartbreaking, and redemptive love that Musana's Musings and community members have for the Twin Cities, showcasing the depth and elasticity of their hearts. Sundays at 7 p.m. on KFAI.
Mike Robbins is our guest this evening. We're talking about two really important books, Focus on the Good Stuff, The Power of Appreciation, and Nothing Changes Until You Do, A Guide to Self-Compassion and Getting Out of the Way. In the name of being compassionate towards ourselves and supposedly loving ourselves, I think that we indulge our egos. And as a part of that, it seems like for so many of us, a fate worse than death is to be proven wrong. So as long as we're right, we will die as opposed to being found wrong. Talk to us about being right.
To our own detriment so often, you know. My wife and I have been together for 14 years, and I have found at times, and it makes me laugh when I even see myself do it, but it's like Michelle and I will get into an argument about something, and I'll be in the middle of the argument. And we, you know, we don't argue a whole lot, but we'll get into it. And then it's like, there will be moments, and maybe some of you listening can relate to this, so I'll realize in the middle of the argument I'm actually wrong and she's right. And then, like, the stubborn part of me will want to keep arguing anyway, right? Because, like, I'm not giving up. I'm going to keep going. And it's like, whoa, whoa, wait a minute. So this obsession with being right is really, really problematic for a lot of us. You know, and there's the great saying, and I believe it to be true, you can either be right or happy, just not both. So if we can let go of that righteousness, that self-righteousness, because look, not only does it become damaging in our relationships, which it absolutely does, we're detrimental in our own lives towards ourselves about being right about certain things. I mean, sometimes, again, we paint ourselves into the corner. I can't do that. I'm not good at that. You know, I saw another quote just, I think it was just today online from Zig Ziglar. He said something about, you know, you don't have to be great to start, but in order to be great, you have to get started. So we have this thing, it's this perfectionist thing, like I have to be great, I have to know exactly what I'm going to do and what I'm going to say, and then I'll start. I can't tell you how many people come up to me over the years talking about, I'm going to write a book one day, you know, and that's great. I mean, it's an aspiration. It's not the easiest thing in the world to do. I know a little bit about that now, but still, it's like, great, why don't you get started? Well, I'm not quite ready yet. You know, and sometimes we're not, and that's fine, but what if it wasn't about being ready, it was just about being willing? Because so many things in life have to do with our willingness, not our readiness. If we could let go of our obsession with being right, so much becomes available. I mean, look, you think of the world we live in these days and the political discourse, which regardless of whatever side of the political spectrum we're on, it's upsetting to all of us, I think, for the most part. It's like we don't know how to listen to each other. We don't know how to disagree. It's all about being right. Mm-hmm. Instead of listening, and sometimes, you know what, maybe someone who looks at the world from a different perspective than we look at has a point. And even if it's not about agreeing with them or saying, yes, I see it your way, it's just understanding that people have valuable perspectives that are different than ours. And it's such a beautiful thing. Like, I actually really enjoy talking to people who see the world differently than I do, even though there's times when it can be uncomfortable for me because I'm like, whoa, this is upsetting to my sort of moral compass or my standard of how things operate or my understanding of how the world works. But gosh, if I can just hang out in that little bit of discomfort and lean into it, I might learn a whole bunch more about stuff that I don't know about, or at the very least, it'll cause me to question and challenge some of my own beliefs and my own opinions, and in the process, make me that much clearer about what's important to me. Hmm. But oftentimes we're too uncomfortable or too afraid to do that. Because what if what turns out at the end is, we're wrong?
Mike Robbins is our guest this evening. We're talking about two really important books, Focus on the Good Stuff, The Power of Appreciation, and Nothing Changes Until You Do, A Guide to Self-Compassion and Getting Out of the Way. The thing that is so interesting, and certainly in talking with you, it's really clear that you have really good self-talk about yourself and about your world. And many of us are addicted to negative self-talk and negative world talk. How do we turn that around?
I mean, I appreciate you saying that. And, you know, I definitely struggle at times with my own self-talk, especially about myself or about the world. And so the couple things that I've done, I mean, I have done a lot of work, internal work on this over the years, because I know how dangerous and damaging that can be. So some of my own personal practices, my meditation practice, my gratitude journaling practice, and also the relationships that I'm in. You know, I try to be as open and loving and accepting of people as possible, but I'm also really, really clear about who I choose to spend my time with, because it just doesn't serve me to be around people who are whining and complaining about life and the world and themselves all the time. Like, it's like, you know, it's almost like a way I think of it sometimes. I hadn't have thought of it this way until just now. It's almost like being a recovering addict. Like, not a good idea if I'm trying to, you know, if I'm sober, to hang around a bunch of people who are drinking, because, like, I might get sucked back into that really easily. It's important for all of us to just be mindful and aware. You know, sometimes, like, turn off the TV. You know, stop engaging in the conversations where the negativity is really palpable. You know, sometimes we're not aware of it. I was over in Europe a few months back. I went into a restaurant to get something to eat, and I was just blown away by the smell of cigarette smoke. Like, whoa. And I realized, wow, the people can smoke inside here. You know, I was in Switzerland, and it's a beautiful place. But I was like, okay, the laws are different. I literally couldn't eat my meal in there because people were smoking. And then I think back, like, I grew up in a house. My mom smoked. There was smoke around me all the time. I mean, I can remember being, right, all of us can remember being in restaurants and on airplanes and in places. And, you know, there's some states here in the U.S. where you can still smoke indoors. Where, you know, I live in California. It's been for at least a decade, you can't smoke inside. So my tolerance level is very low now to that, just as an example. The same thing is true with negativity. If we're around a lot of negativity, we tend to build up a certain tolerance level for it. And so while it's counterintuitive, what we want to start to do is lower our tolerance level for that amount of negativity. You know, and again, it's a personal choice. I'm not saying this from some moral place. We just got to know what works for us. You know, I mean, again, I notice certain things have changed in my life. Like, I have a lot lower threshold for, say, violent movies, because I don't watch them, because I have young kids and my wife's not really into it. So, like, if I'm on an airplane and the person next to me is watching a really violent movie on their computer or their iPad or something, like, I notice it's super upsetting for me because I'm not used to seeing that. So, again, for each of us, just look in the environment. It's not about, like, kicking people out of your life saying, you're too negative, get away from me, but starting to notice, who am I around? What conversations am I engaging in? What types of things do I listen to? What types of things do I choose to put into my conscious awareness? Now, look, there's stuff happening in the world. We can insulate ourselves as much as we want, and there's still negative things that happen in the world. So this is not about avoiding negativity per se, but it's about how we choose to engage with it. And I think there's a lot of things that we do unconsciously that contribute to it that we can shift. Again, think about healthy living, as you talk about, right? It's like, what do I choose to put into my body? Now, it's not about, in my opinion, for what it's worth, it's not about being, you know, crazy, crazy uptight about every single thing, but it's about a conscious awareness that if I put healthier things into my body, I'm probably going to feel better than if I don't. The same is true with food. The same is true with thoughts. The same is true with things we focus on. So it's looking at life from that holistic approach.
You also talk about allowing our light to shine, and you mentioned Marianne Williamson in her famous quote about it's our light that we most fear, not our darkness. Talk about our light.
Yeah, you know, it's an interesting thing. I mean, there's that great quote that many of us have heard from Marianne Williamson that she wrote in her book Return to Love, and often gets misattributed to Nelson Mandela, but she said, you know, it's our deepest fear. Our deepest fear is not that we are inadequate, it's that we are powerful beyond measure. And really, I think, in some ways, you know, it's a tricky thing, because I remember years ago, my uncle, Steve, who's been a mentor and a guide for me for many, many years, I remember him saying this thing to me. I was in my early 20s. It was after baseball had ended, and I was trying to figure some things out, and I'd really started to step down this path of personal growth and empowerment. And he said to me, kind of in a cautionary way, he said, listen, Mike, I want to tell you something. He says, as you start to step more and more into your power, many people will gravitate towards you and will really appreciate it, but there will be people who won't like it at all. And just be mindful of that. And I said, what do you mean? He said, it's not like, I'm not saying to be paranoid, but like, you start shining your light, it can upset some people. So that's one of the things I think we've all experienced in life, right? And it's not, again, I don't think of it from a paranoid perspective. You know, and there's this word that gets thrown around on the internet these days, and people are haters and all that stuff. And look, there is that. But in a genuine way, we start shining our light, it can be a little scary for us because, oh my gosh, look, it's a lot easier to complain and to whine and to feel small and to feel like you're getting, you know, it's not fair and I'm a victim. And look, that's more of the cultural conversation that most of us live in. There's a lot of acceptance for whining and complaining. Stepping into our power, not as much acceptance for that. And what happens is people can sometimes react somewhat negatively, as odd as it may seem. Who do you think you are? Or, oh, you know, what are you so happy? I mean, I was actually listening to an interview. It was actually Elizabeth Gilbert again, who was on Super Soul Sunday with Oprah, talking about people have this funny thing about happiness or being happy or being fulfilled that, like, you're almost not supposed to talk about it because, like, it's, like, superstitious. Like, you're tempting fate. Like, you talk about how happy and blessed you are, then something bad's going to happen, right? I think that's – I understand that. That shows up in my own mind from time to time as well, but I think that's kind of crazy. That really, and Marianne talks about it in that beautiful quote, right? There's nothing enlightened about us shrinking so that people won't feel insecure around us. Mm-hmm. What we're really supposed to do is step into that power and then give other people permission to do the same. So we sort of keep raising the bar for ourselves, if you will, and in the process, it will hopefully inspire and empower other people to step into that. But, you know, we got to be willing. And sometimes, you know, and I've had this experience in my life, as I'm sure every single person listening, sometimes we actually get scared or confronted by our own power. We'll do something, we'll experience something, we'll start to shine our light. It's like, whoa, 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 that's even too bright for me. So we dim it. Mm-hmm. You know, we sabotage our own success. And this is a journey for myself. Just even in the last few years, I started to notice this pattern, like things will start to go really well. And then I'll almost get uncomfortable with it going so well that, like, oh, I'll create some kind of drama or trauma or difficulty in my life because part of how I've been quote-unquote successful in my life is that I'm a survivor, man. I'll overcome. I can work through adversity. Like, you know, I realized, oh, I got to be willing to give up that part of my persona if I really want life to be able to flourish with a certain amount of ease and abundance. And each of us, we're all a little different and unique in our own way that we're sort of wired up, if you will, in our own belief system. But again, for everyone listening, think about the ways in which you sabotage your own success. And it may be a fear of really letting your light shine. Mm. You know, because the other thing that does happen in our culture is that the more you step forward, back to vulnerability we were talking about earlier, it's actually vulnerable because people now potentially might say something, might do something. Right? You raise your hand in class. You have an opportunity to contribute, you might get the answer wrong, right? People might make fun of you. People might disagree with you. Look, and that's one of the biggest things, you know, again, when I've heard people come up to me say, I want to write a book, I always say to them, look, there's the practical part of it, and then there's the emotional part of it, and you got to be prepared for both. And writing a book is a metaphor for a lot of things, right? Are we willing to do it, to put ourselves out there in that way? Because once you do, as I've learned in my own life and my own work, you can't control what people say or think about it.
you end nothing changes until you do with live your life like you're going to die because you are.
Yep.
Talk about that.
Yeah. You know, it's pretty, it's a little heavy in some ways, but I write a lot in that book about my mom who passed away in 2011. She got diagnosed with lung cancer in March of that year and died in June. So it was 3 months from diagnosis to her death. And on the one hand, and anybody listening who's experienced the loss of somebody close knows, I mean, it was incredibly painful and it was tragic. It was really, really sad and hard to experience and hard to be with. My father had passed away back in 2001. You know, the experience of realizing my mother's very sick and she's suffering and she's going to die and then trying not to have it be all about me, but oh my gosh, both of my parents will be gone and my daughter's, you know, I mean, all of the different swirl of thought and feeling and emotion, but it was also, as difficult and painful and sad as it was one of the most extraordinary experiences of growth, of connection, of life that I have ever had. And I think, again, most people I talk to, again, death is such a important aspect of life that we don't often talk about because we're scared to talk about it, because it's so emotional, because it's so oftentimes we're in some version of our own grief process and life's still moving 100 miles an hour and we're trying to get stuff done and get up and go to work and, you know, feed our kids and pay our bills and do all this stuff. So it's like inconvenient, if you will, which is kind of ironic because it's one of the only things we know that's going to happen to all of us. But one of the most poignant moments I had in the whole experience was about a month after my mom had been diagnosed. I had spent the night at her house, which is the house we grew up in Oakland. They bought that house. My parents bought that house when I was in utero with my mom. So it had literally been the one and only family home that we had. And I had spent the night. She was starting to get pretty sick. I was obviously upset, concerned about her, but also just really emotionally triggered by being in the house that I grew up in and being there and everything going on. And I got up in the morning early because I didn't sleep that well. And I went out for a run, kind of clear my mind. And I'm on this run. I'm here. I mean, I'm in the neighborhood where I rode my bike, where I rode my big wheel. I'm having all these flashbacks of memories from childhood and adolescence. Then I start thinking about my mom, and I start thinking, gosh, I wonder what it's like for her right now, knowing that she's going to die. I mean, it's, you know, it's pretty obvious that the end is coming, and it may be coming sooner than we even think. And like, what? That must be really scary. And what would that be like? And, you know, I'm like, I'm just thinking about this. I'm feeling a lot. And then all of a sudden I stopped. I literally stopped running, like stopped in my tracks and went, wait a minute. I know I'm going to die. It just doesn't seem imminent at the moment. I mean, I don't have a diagnosis or a specific, like, I don't know when, and I hope it's a long time from now. And especially as a father now, I think about it and sometimes I get scared about it and I hope, oh gosh, but I sort of avoid it. And as I stopped and was walking back home, I thought to myself, you know what? Probably be a good idea for me to live my life with more awareness of that on a regular basis. Not to freak myself out, but the reality is I'm going to die. So are you. So is every single person on the planet. Like, we all know that. We just sort of live like that's not the case. And if we live our lives more aware of our own deaths on a daily basis, I think a lot of the things that we worry about and wonder about and hold ourselves back from and protect ourselves from, all those things, I think we'd live very differently, and I think we'd make different choices. And I really think it's such an important consciousness for us to carry in life on a daily basis, because so much of the stuff that we allow to dictate our moods and our perspectives and our stress levels and all that stuff, really not that big of a deal in the big scheme of things.
Mike Robbins has 3 amazing books. And they all really say the same thing in such beautiful, different ways. And at the same time, it always comes, I mean, and I guess that's the way that truth is. It always is just one thing. The first book being Be Yourself, Everyone Else Is Already Taken. Focus on the Good Stuff. It's a book on the power of appreciation, and his latest contribution, Nothing Changes Until You Do, a guide to self-compassion and getting out of your own way. Mike Robbins has been our guest, and his website is beautiful. Obviously, your conversation is beautiful, and I appreciate being in this conversation with you again, because I don't think that we can hear enough how amazing we are and appreciating ourselves and appreciating others.